Get the lowdown on the publishing industry. Listen to Writers on Writing, hosted by Barbara DeMarco Barrett. She talks to anyone who's anyone in publishing. Thursdays, 5 p.m.
on KCI-FM in Irvine.
Weekly Signals, every Tuesday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. Join me, Mike Casper, and Nathan Callahan for the best in reality-based radio. That's Weekly Signals. Check out the website at weeklysignals.com.
And you don't hear none of those stations playing them. Ask why. In fact, where are those stations today? Somebody better ask somebody that. The people that's most affected by this war.
From animal rights and the anti-war movement to civil disobedience and culture jamming, Justice or Just Us examines law, equality, public policy, and social activism. Tune in Thursdays, 8 to 9 a.m. on KUCI in Irvine and KUCI.org.
The opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily represent those of the management of KUCI or the UC Board of Regents. For more information about this show, go to KUCI.org.
And hello again, and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI-FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus and on the web at KUCI.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing, as usual, features authors, editors, poets, literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. Thank goodness. And today my guests are Martin J. Smith and Kate Braverman. First up is Marty Smith. He's senior editor of West, the Los Angeles Times Sunday Magazine. He's author of three suspense novels, including Strawman, a 2002 Edgar Award nominee. And he's co-author of the new book, Oops, 20 Life Lessons from Fiascos That Shaped America, published by Collins, a HarperCollins imprint. Hi, Marty.
Hey, Barbara. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Good.
So, Oops. Now, tell me about this one. Where did this one come from? Popolorica was the last book.
Yeah, Popolorica came out in 2004, and Popolorica was the first book that Pat and I wrote together, Pat Kiger, and it was a collection of 20 oddly pivotal moments in American contemporary culture, things that changed everything, you know, everything from the disposable diaper to the movie Night of the Living Dead and how it reshaped horror movies in America. There was one chapter in Popolorica that was about a great failure. It was a chapter about how the Edsel forever changed how cars are designed and marketed. And when we got around to finishing that book and started looking at the next project, we realized how appealing failures really are. You know, successes are kind of overrated, really, when you think about entertainment value. You know, it's the failures that are the most fun. And so we started thinking about the idea of doing an entire book that looked at these huge failures that ended up having wide cultural ripple effects. And that's what led us to write Oops.
So how did you come up with these? I mean, did you start with a list of, say, oh, I don't know, 100? Or because in the book, let me see, you have, how many do you have? 20?
We have 20, yeah. And you're almost exactly right on that. We start with, you know, by throwing out on the table every potential possibility of a great failure. And we probably ended up with about 100. I know with Popolorica, we had 200 ideas on the table, which we then winnowed down to 20. In the case of Oops, maybe we got a little bit more efficient and threw out about 100 ideas and chose the 20 that we thought would work best as a book. Now, of course, we weeded out the ones that were, you know, sort of unspeakably tragic. You know, they're not fun. You know, there are great disasters that didn't cost human lives. And, you know, who wants to really read more about that in this day and age? So, you know, we looked for you know, just ridiculously embarrassing public fiascos that, you know, that didn't really have any total downside.
Mm-hmm.
And filtered out the 20 that we thought would be best.
It's funny. I mean, some of these are so funny. The Jimi Hendrix Monkey Tour.
Well, you know, again, we try in each of these books, we try to sample from culture. We wanted it to be sort of a smorgasbord. And we knew we were looking at, you know, everything from sports to movies to music. And the one that we decided to do in music was this remarkable, sort of utterly dumbfoundingly ridiculous idea that happened in 1966, where a promoter decided that the perfect pairing of musical acts to take on the road would be the Monkees, who were at their height of fame at that point. They had a TV show that they had essentially been put together by creative people who didn't necessarily care about the music but wanted four photogenic guys to be stars of a TV sitcom, and music would be sort of incidental to that. And they created the Monkees. They were called by people who didn't particularly care for them, the Prefab Four. And yet they took them out on the road, and this was, you know, back before lip-syncing scandals were big, but they took them out on the road and decided that the perfect opening act for these guys was this guy who had just made a big splash at the Monterey Pop Festival that year, this guy named Jimi Hendrix. And, you know, the Monkees' audience was predominantly 10- and 11-year-old girls and their moms. And here comes this pairing with Jimi Hendrix, who at the time was sort of the, still is sort of the paragon of, the guitar god, you know, with sort of, if you'll excuse me, they call it cock rock. It was, you know, very sexual and very charged. And, you know, they put him on first, and they were booing him off the stage. The mothers were outraged. And it lasted about six shows. But it's one of those things, looking back on it, you think, you know, what were they thinking?
Mm-hmm. It's just funny. I mean, it must have been fun actually doing this book and coming up with the list and then, you know, winnowing it down. But how do you do it with a collaborator who lives far away?
Pat and I actually go back to college. We went to Penn State together, and we've worked together at a number of publications over the years. So we're very close friends. We've always been sounding boards for one another in terms of stories and ideas. And it just seemed like a very natural collaboration. I had the idea for Poplorica one day on the way in from work, into work during my commute. And the first thing I did was get into work and pick up the phone and call Pat and say, hey, I had this idea. What do you think? And it just started getting an energy of its own from that point. So there was really never any question that this would evolve into a collaborative effort. Interestingly, our writing styles are very, very similar. And so, you know, once we've come up with the list of 20, which is really is the most fun part of doing these books, once we've come up with that final list, there are ones that I have a particular interest in. There may be ones he's got a particular interest in. And we take those and we divvy them up. And you know, he writes half the book and I write half the book. And even my mother, you know, can't really tell who writes what chapter.
One that I wish had made it in, and I understand why it didn't, you have it back in the chapter, Fiascos That Failed to Qualify for Oops, and the Amphicar. I remember that little car.
Yeah, it was, you know, it was kind of a classic.
But it just wasn't big enough to really qualify for Oops.
Well, we have an entire chapter on flying cars. You know, each of these chapters we tried to couch in the context of the historical lesson that we can learn from this fiasco. And the lesson of chapter 20, which is about the flying car, is occasionally look up from your workbench. And the idea of the flying car is that, you know, we've been pursuing a flying car now for a century. The Amphicar was actually one of those sort of weird experiments. But after a century, we really don't need a flying car anymore. The idea of the internet, where you actually, you know, it used to be that you had to imagine being physically present in a place to actually be there. Well, you don't need that anymore. And yet there are endless entrepreneurs still hard at work on flying cars, even though the need for them has completely disappeared. They need to occasionally look up from their workbenches. but you're right. The Amphicar was one of those that we were going to pull out and make one of those chapters, but it just wasn't quite enough.
You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm talking with Martin J. Smith, who is co-author of Oops, 20 Life Lessons from the Fiascos That Shaped America. You do a lot of different things. As I, you know, read about you in the beginning, I was thinking you You're an editor of a Sunday magazine for the LA Times. You have written mystery novels. Mm-hmm. You write nonfiction books. How do you sort it all out? And do you do all of those things at once, or do you have like one major project at a time while you're working at the Times? And where does fiction figure in to it these days?
Well, you know,
because we want you to write more fiction, Marty.
Well, thank you. That's very nice of you to say. And I'm flattered by the question. I do, you know, fancy myself somewhat of a multitasker. And, you know, I've always got two or three things on a back burner that I want to work on, that I've got sort of in various stages of development, whether it be a novel or a nonfiction book idea or a collection of essays, or all those things are sort of percolating along, and I'm working on them here and there. You know, but every once in a while, I'll be sort of seized by, you know, a real passion to pick up one of those things and just follow it through to its end. And that's kind of how I've been letting myself, you know, build my career, is just, you know, when something moves me enough to do all the hard work that's necessary to produce a book, then I know it's probably a pretty good idea and probably a pretty good impulse, and I tend to follow it. How do I balance it with my work at West Magazine, at the Los Angeles Times? Well, you know, I have a friend that calls me the Rain Man because I'm so regimented in my, you know, the structure of my day. I show up at work at exactly the same time every morning after having worked for 2 hours in the morning and, you know, then done an hour-long commute. I come in and I work very hard for an eight-hour day, and then I turn around and I leave and I go to bed and I get up and do the same thing in the morning. I think, you know, I can't speak for anybody else, but I have to do it that way. I'm trying to balance raising two kids and essentially juggling two careers at the same time, and I have to be very regimented about how I do it. It makes me a very dull guy.
Oh, no. You are just so humble here. But I always tell a story to my students about you when you worked at Orange Coast, and I remember you said before your first novel came out that you would get up at something like 4 a.m. and write fiction for a couple of hours before the kids got up and before you had to go to work at Orange Coast. Because, you know, you always hear, I have no time to write. And I always think of you, and I think, if he can get up at 4 a.m, write fiction, get the kids up, go to work, so can you.
Well, I mean, that was the philosophy I was working under at the time, and still do, I guess. And it's simply that you're never going to find the time to write. You know, you have to make it, and you have to clear away space in your day and space in your brain to do it every day, or roughly every day. You know, my formula is very simple, and it doesn't necessarily apply to anyone else but me. But, you know, 10 hours a week is what I try to devote to those little outside projects that are always percolating along. That's 2 hours a day, 5 days a week. Whether that translates into 10 pages of text or, you know, finishing up a proposal or writing an essay or whatever it is, 10 hours a week, you can get a heck of a lot of work done. And over the course of a year, that's 520 hours, and you can do a lot in 520 hours. And, you know, but the key is, I think, just the discipline. And I don't get up at 4 o'clock in the morning anymore. I did that for 7 or 8 years while I was producing those novels. And that was really hard, I have to admit. It was something I don't necessarily want to go back to doing again right now. But my kids are, you know, not young and as high maintenance as they were during those years. In fact, they, you know, would rather not hang around with me anymore. So, you know, I do find myself with a little bit more free time on weekends and in evenings where I can actually devote myself to writing at more reasonable hours.
Hmm. Well, you are listening to Writers on Writing. We have a few minutes left with Martin J. Smith, author of Oops, 20 Life Lessons from the Fiascos That Shaped America, published by Collins. And I have to say, this cover is funny, too, because at the top of it, it says trim book cover here. And there's that color key, and it looks like a mistake.
You know, I have to admit, I've grown to love that cover. But I will admit that I was actually one of the people that argued against that, because I thought it was a little bit too much of an inside joke. And I just thought, you know, not everybody's going to get it. And Collins, my editor at Collins, made a very persuasive argument. She said, you know what, it's not a bad idea. First of all, the people that get it are going to get it, and the people that don't aren't, and that's not really anything to worry about. But she said, it's really not a bad idea to have every bookstore owner in America walking past your book and stopping to straighten it. I thought, you know, maybe she's on to something here.
Really, because it does get your attention. I kind of did a double take and went, oh, I wonder if this was a mistake.
and then you see the title.
And then I saw the title and I went, oh, it has to be on purpose here, okay? Mm-hmm. But, yeah, that was great. Any advice for the writers listening? Anything you can offer about how you get yourself started when it seems like nothing wants to start? Do you ever have times like that where you sit down and you go, this is my time to work on my book and or my whatever I'm working on, and I can't get going, and the refrigerator is beckoning? What do you do?
You know, I've always sort of been a creature of instinct, and you know, I try not to force ideas. If there's an idea that's percolating in the back of my mind and I think it would be kind of interesting, you know, I wait for it to speak to me and then I get excited about it. But I mean, I think so many of us try to say, okay, I'm going to write a novel, and this is the novel I'm going to write, and I'm going to start writing it. And, you know, maybe we haven't thought it through very well at that point, and it just hasn't sort of clicked into the passion gene yet. And you know, I've learned over the years to just kind of, you know, quiet yourself and listen. And the thing that you end up thinking about is the thing you should be thinking about, the thing that's got you excited or interested. You know, your attention goes to that. And again, that's how I move those ideas from, you know, a back burner possibility to a front burner book. You know, I wait for it to say, you know what, this is what really interests me at this very moment, and I pursue that. I think it's a learned technique as opposed to, I mean, it sounds like an instinct, but it's something that I've had to teach myself that, you know, it's got to excite me for me to summon the energy to be able to pursue it for a year or whatever it takes to write a book.
As opposed to the shoulds and all of those sort of things we say to ourselves about why we should be doing it. It's not coming from a place of, I've got to do it.
Exactly. But I do, you know, I do think it's important to, you know, if you're going to force yourself to do something, force yourself to think about writing something every day and then trust your instincts from that point forward, you know, which one comes to the fore. And it will. One of those ideas will come to the fore and you'll start pursuing it. But you got to force yourself to think about it every day and sit down at a computer and, you know, start hacking at it every day. And then, you know, wait to see what really sparks you.
How do you tell the difference between boredom with a project and just, you know, just sort of going slow on something? You know, I mean, there are some times when maybe you should leave something alone, and other times when you just maybe don't know what to do next and you need to push through that, not knowing what to do next.
Yeah, you know, interesting question, the way you phrase it, the difference between boredom and going slow and being careful and thoughtful. For me, you know, it needs to be self-motivating. It needs to have its own energy and move, have its own momentum. If it doesn't, if I'm trying to push it rather than trying to chase it, you know, I think that's the difference. That's when I know that, you know, I'm pushing it rather than trying to catch up to this thing.
Mm.
You know, for me, that's when I can feel that. And I'd much rather be chasing a great idea that's out ahead of me.
Mm-hmm. That's a wonderful way of putting it.
Well, thanks.
Thanks so much, Marty.
No, happy to be here.
And, best of luck with this. I can't wait to see it move and do what it's going to do.
Thank you very much.
That was Marty Smith. He's author of Oops, 20 Life Lessons from the Fiascos That Shaped America, published by Collins, an imprint of HarperCollins. And he's also editor of West, the LA Times Sunday Magazine, author of three mysteries that are in print and wonderful. Okay, and he speaks to us from Los Angeles. We're going to take a break now because we have to end early tonight, because a basketball game is coming on, the Anteaters. That means my show's over early, about 5:45. And I'm going to take a break, get Kate Braverman on the phone, and hopefully she will be here when we get back. Don't go anywhere.
come back, baby. Please don't go. No, I love you, darling. Hate to see you go. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child. Seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time.
Listen to Writers on Writing, hosted by Barbara DeMarco Barrett on Thursdays at 5 p.m. on KUCI FM in Irvine. Bye-bye.
Yee-haw! Weekly Signals, every Tuesday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. Join me, Mike Casper, and Nathan Callahan for the best in reality-based radio. That's Weekly Signals. Check out the website at weeklysignals.com.
You don't hear none of those stations playing them. Ask why. In fact, where are those stations today? Somebody better ask somebody that. The people that's most affected by this war.
From animal rights and the anti-war movement to civil disobedience and culture jamming, Justice or Just Us examines law, equality, public policy, and social activism. Tune in Thursdays 8 to 9 a.m. on KUCI in Irvine and KUCI.org.
Hey, welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM, broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at KUCI.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. If you want to know more about this show, you can go to penonfire.com. Click on the radio tower. It'll take you to the radio page. We are podcasting these days, too, which means that a few dozen shows or more, probably more because some CDs have two shows on them, are archived on the website. You don't need a Mac to listen to the shows, even though they are podcasts. You can listen on your PC. This show, tonight's show, will be on next Tuesday, I believe. We'll get it on there. So you can listen again or tell your friends what a wonderful show it was. And check out Marty Smith and Kate Braverman Tuesday and onwards when the show is uploaded to the podcast. My next guest is Kate Braverman. She's author of four novels, two collections of short fiction, and four books of poetry. Her new book is Frantic Transmissions to and from Los Angeles, a collection of essays that won the 2005 Grey Wolf Press Nonfiction Prize. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Barbara.
How are you doing?
I'm great. How are you doing?
I'm fine. Talk about this new book of essays. How did this come about?
Well, I've always been writing essays as well as poetry, novels, and short stories. And actually, I don't think there's really a distinct line between genres anymore. In my examination of the writing of the 70s, it's pretty clear to me that between Joan Didion, Tom Wolfe, and Hunter Thompson, that what they did was pretty much demolish the the patrician vestiges of genre, you know, the little categories that men have erected across their literary terrain. So I feel that that nonfiction is totally open for fiction writers. And so that's what I've done. So this book is really an incredibly interesting conglomeration of things that you wouldn't think could work together, but they work brilliantly. And so would you like to hear an example of doing Jewish history as stand-up comedy?
Of course.
Okay. So this is after the Shell Economist Prize essay. That's the first essay in there about Los Angeles. Then it's like Leaving Los Angeles by Incantations and Magic, which is a long poem that's pretending to be another essay. And then I like this of adding Escaping Los Angeles, Uncle Irving's Advice. So why don't I give you a taste of this? Because, first of all, women do not engage the page with things like stand-up comedy very often. In fact, comedy is usually closed to women. It's not something they do, which made it attractive to me. So here's Uncle Irving's advice. You want to leave Los Angeles? What are you, crazy? You don't need an overcoat here. The whole world wants to come to L.A. and you want to leave. Listen, remember, we're not the classic Jews you read about, the endorsed version, how they leap off the ship in Ellis Island. The father works 20 hours a day. He's a tailor. He goes blind so his son can be a neurosurgeon or conduct the Boston Symphony. The father, call him Marvin, keeps sewing. He's completely blind at this point, but he has to put his son through med school. All right, so then we go into the climbing steep, unlit steps up to the tenement. The kids are doing their third or fourth set of optional extra credit book reports by candlelight. They're memorizing the next 3 weeks' spelling lists while practicing the violin. The mother is watching. Call her Sophie. She can't speak English yet, but can intuit a spelling mistake by some form of telepathy. She knows how long violin practice lasts. She doesn't need a watch. It goes until you have carpal tunnel syndrome. That's a normal night. And then they're ready for the night marital ritual. And it wasn't sex. Who had strength? It was verbal tenderness. Marvin, what do you think, a dentist? Sophie closes her eyes in a kind of passion. Those hands, Marvin, the fingers of a cardiologist. Marvin embraces her in darkness. That's because it's freezing in there, and the only candle is in the room where the boys do math homework. I think brain surgery, Marvin says. Brain surgery, Sophie repeats. They say it in unison, and it's the Jewish version of an orgasm.
So how did this essay begin?
The advice, Uncle Irving's advice?
Yeah.
Well, it began by the idea that I wanted to write stand-up comedy. And how do you do stand-up comedy for the page? And it's extremely difficult. And I thought that it would lend itself well to telling ghastly stories, like the Jewish history in America and the extra-Jewish diaspora of leaving the East Coast for Los Angeles. So it was like exile within exile within exile. And I felt that it would lend itself well to stand-up comedy. And there's a lot of very funny things in there. I know that because I've been reading them to audiences and people are cracking up like it was real stand-up comedy. And this happened to me at the Petaluma Library last night where there were very few Jewish people. And I did not expect it to be a sophisticated crowd, like when I read at Dutton's and people were, you know, laughing like it was Richard Pryor or something, which is always a surprise for a serious writer when that occurs. But at the Petaluma Library, which is a little town in Northern California, people were laughing like that during Uncle Irving's advice.
Hmm. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm talking with Kate Braverman, author of Frantic Transmissions to and from Los Angeles, published by Grey Wolf Press. So the way essays begin, similar to how poetry, stories, novels begin, or do different things happen and you go, this one's an essay, this one's a novel, this one's a story, this one's a poem. What's the difference? How do you know?
I don't think there's any difference for me, and I've been asked that question a lot, and I just go back to the basic. Neruda says there's two things that make a piece. There's the net, then there's the air that falls through the meshes, and I'm an air that falls through the meshes kind of girl, and I believe that language of a certain order will naturally have its own DNA in it. It will form its own morphology. It will take care of the decisions your characters make. You don't have to inflict anything on it when you have the alchemy. So since all I have are piles and acres and football fields of alchemy, I can take the magic stuff and call it an essay or call it a short story or call it a novel if it gets big enough. You know, I don't care about the distinctions between categories. I just care if it's brilliant writing.
You've said something to the effect of, where poetry reaches so few people because nobody's buying poetry, why not take all of those same elements and make it a bigger story, make it into a novel?
Well, it's not just that. It's also that women have had such a short time to inhabit the page. Let us remember that we did not get the vote until 1919, so that women really have not had very long to make an imprint on literature. When we talk about literature, we're only talking about what men have seen and written and what other men have said about what these men have seen and written. And that goes for reality as well. When we talk about reality, we're just talking about what men have measured, charted, and defined. Women have not had a chance to participate. And so I think that particularly as a woman and as a California writer, that we are a region of experimentation. And that what's going on in New York, I've just come back from 2 months on tour, and nobody in this country is interested about what's going on in New York except for the people in New York. They don't care in Detroit. They don't care in Ann Arbor. They don't care in San Diego. They don't care in San Francisco. They don't care in Seattle, and they don't care in Texas are some of the places I've been. The only people who care about the rules and regulations of how it's supposed to be are the people in New York. And I think that California should stop taking this, we're just a little outpost of the giant empire situated in New York. We live in a global world, and I think it's time for California writers to get their due nationally and internationally.
You lived in New York, upstate New York, for, 10 years?
What? To say that we were in New York is sort of not quite right, because when you're a 7-hour drive from New York City, you're not in New York.
Mm-hmm.
We were in the Allegheny Mountains, Appalachia. We were one wrong turn from Pennsylvania, and it's a part of the country that is so poor. We were in the poorest county of New York State. And they call the border there Pentucky.
Hmm. How was it to be there and to be a writer from California in terms of your own work? What sort of changes took place in your work being so far away? Did anything change?
I think that I carry my isolation with me, so that wasn't a problem. And isolation, I've always liked. People are, for me, an acquired taste, which is probably why I don't have very many friends in important places who will invite me to good conferences and give me honorariums, but that's okay. But nonetheless, I found that my California sensibility was suspect in this little town, and that just because we came from California, that that brought along a lot of negative baggage with us. We were suspected always of not being like the other people in our little town, and boy, were they right.
You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI-FM. I'm with Kate Braverman for a few minutes more. We're ending early tonight because there's a basketball game, and I'm going to be preempted by a basketball game. In any case, we have her for five more minutes. Well, also, I guess, in terms of working and writing and promotion, how... I know you've been a great proponent of writing exercises and just getting yourself going in various ways without plots, worked out plots, without outlines. Your books do seem to be plotted, and I know you once said to me that you weren't known for your plots, but I find plot and story all over your stuff. And so how do you come up with it? Do you start writing with an idea, and do you see where it leads, or do you have some general idea that perhaps is not written down but is there nevertheless when you start writing?
Well, the next book that I write is probably going to be something called The Art and Craft of Alchemy, and I will explain to people exactly how I achieve the effects that I achieve. And I think I can do this very easily because I have had to deconstruct the Grey Wolf book when they censored my ending, and I had to disconnect myself from Grey Wolf officially. And so I then had to deconstruct the book, so I know exactly. I could do an annotated version, and I love teaching from this book because I know exactly how I achieved the effects that I achieved. I know how to access the alchemy, and I also know once you have the magical threads, I know how to stitch, nail, glue, collage, build the bridges, do the things that are necessary to make them adhere and coalesce. And I do have these secrets, and they don't have to be secrets. I plan to share them with the world.
Oh, Kate, we are so miserably at the end of our time. Do you have any words of, you have lots of words of wisdom for writers. Anything you can tell us right now?
I think that the idea of being experimental is that you sit down and you have no idea what you're going to do. And one of the great things that I like to tell my writers when they work with me is not to use your eyes, because we live in an image-saturated age, and that I'm more interested in what you're thinking, what you're hearing, what you're smelling, to start to use your senses more synergistically and get away from this constant assault of what the visual is. That's a good help. And any place where you have a period, put a comma in and go on for 10 more pages where you think it's over. And by putting in the commas, forget punctuation. You can always go back and punctuate. But that's how I get the alchemy, basically, is I just keep putting commas in, and that forces you to say a lot more about what you were planning to talk about than if you could have let yourself just put a period in. And after 10 pages of comma, and you keep going, comma, and you keep going, you will find that you are writing what you don't yet know. That's how you get the alchemy. The only way that can happen is by an act of discovery. And you can discover by walking the plank into the Bay of Sharks. And the way you do that is one comma at a time across. And then after you've done your 10 pages, then make it 20 pages, 30 pages. And then you will find that you are engaged in alchemy.
Thank you so much, Kate.
Well, thank you, Barbara.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you. And
are you sure you're talking to me and not a bipolar delusion?
Well, you know, I think I'm talking to you.
Okay, well, these days we just don't know.
I'm going to direct everyone to your website, katebraverman.com.
Okay, and Barbara, are we going to hook up to my web? Does that happen automatically?
I'm not sure I know what you mean.
Well, I've got, like, web capability where I'm podcasting different things, so can I podcast you?
You probably can.
Okay, well, I'm sure these instructions will be sent to me somehow.
Okay.
Okay, Barbara, you have a good one.
Thanks, Kate. That was Kate Braverman speaking to us from Los Angeles. Her book is Frantic Transmissions to and from Los Angeles, won the 2005 Grey Wolf Press Nonfiction Prize. If you want to know more about this show, go to penonfire.com, click on the radio tower. It'll bring you to the radio page. You'll find out all you need to know. And I'm going to leave you with a quote from Jane Smiley, who said, "Even if my marriage is falling apart and my children aren't happy, there is still a part of me that says, God, this is fascinating." Thanks for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Until next week.